Okay, so good afternoon, and we'll talk about the proton radius puzzle. It has also been mentioned in the previous talk. So first of all, what is the proton radius puzzle, for those of you not familiar? So if you look at the matrix element of electromagnetic current between two nucleon states, you get two form factors, F1 and F2, also known as the Dirac and Pauli form factors. And you can define this linear combination of these form factors known as the electric and magnetic form factors. And the physical meaning of some of these things is that, for example, if you look at the value of this function at zero, so for the electric form factor of the proton, you will get just the charge of the proton in units of E, while for the magnetic form factor, you get the magnetic moment of the form factor. In general, for protons, these are non-perturbative functions. Now, if you think about something like a Taylor expansion, the next thing you want to know after the value at zero is what's the slope at zero. And the slope at zero defines what we mean by the proton charge radius. So there's a 6 here that's a convention, and with the 6, the units, it's roughly 1 femtometer or 10 to the minus 15 meters. So this is what we call the charge radius. You can similarly define the magnetic radius just as by the normalized slope of the magnetic form factor. Okay, so this has to do with probing the proton or the nucleon more generally using some electromagnetic current. So you can think of several methods of accessing the charge radius. So one thing you can do is electron-proton scattering. You measure these functions, extract them from measurement, and extrapolate to zero to find the slope. You can also use atomic physics. So you can use spectroscopy of regular hydrogen. And more recently, or since 2010, you can also use spectroscopy of muonic hydrogen. So this was first done in 2010. And by the Krima collaboration, they measured the lamp shift of muonic hydrogen and got a value of around 0.84. There was an update a couple of years later, pretty much 0.84. Now, if you compare it to the value you get from averaging both scattering and spectroscopic hydrogen data, you get a number that's close to something more like 0.88. Now, you can see that the muonic hydrogen error is an order of magnitude smaller. This is something that was expected. But if you also look at the difference between these two things, you get something that is 5 sigma discrepancy. It depends on which value exactly you're looking, but it could be something between 5 of 7 sigma discrepancy. Now, when there's we talked about flavor physics anomalies that were 2 to 3 sigma, people get super excited and write tons of papers. So here is full 5 sigma discrepancy, and the question is, what are we doing with that? So this is what is known the proton radius puzzle. So this made it to the cover of Nature magazine. You can see how Nature magazine thinks you measure the proton radius fairly easy. Okay, so what could be the reason for this discrepancy? So it could be a problem with the electronic extraction. And this will be the first part of my talk. It could be something with hadronic uncertainty. The extraction of the proton charge radius from muonic hydrogen relies on input from theory. And there could be that the theoretical uncertainty has been underestimated. That's going to be the second part of my talk. There could be, obviously, the most exciting option is new physics, because we've seen that muons are misbehaving in many areas, so it seems like it. So maybe the muons are trying to tell us something, and we should just listen. One disclaimer, I will focus on published work that I was involved in. I will mention a little bit about the other approaches, but this is going to be the focus. So here's the outline. So we just finished the introduction. I will talk in the first part of proton radii from scattering. This is something that's also relevant for neutrino physics. The part two, I'll talk about the hadronic uncertainty with the question. And part three, I will talk about the way of accessing this hadronic uncertainty by connecting muon proton scattering and muonic hydrogen measurements. And I'll finish with some conclusions. So the first part is proton radii from scattering. So what's the problem with finding the proton charge radius just for measuring form factors? The problem is these form factors are non-perturbative objects, and nobody knows the exact functional form of these functions. And they don't have to have a simple dipole or polynomial or spline or any other functional form that we imagine. So including such models can bias, and unfortunately did bias, extraction of the charge radius. And for neutrino physicists in the audience, the same applies for the axial form factor. It doesn't have to be a dipole. So I'm not so sure, but yeah.
ones in the audience.
The ones in the audience, excellent, very good. So what we do know is the analytic properties of these form factors. And these are analytic outside a cut in a complex plane that starts at the 2 pi n threshold. And this is known since 1958. In 2012, I gave a talk at Ann Arbor about this. And at the end of the talk came this older gentleman and said, I actually worked on this. And that turned out to be the person, Federbusch, that did his PhD on this. He moved to other fields in math, actually. So we know the analytic structure, that there's singularity starts here. Scattering data lies on the t equal q squared negative values of t. So what you can do is you can map the domain of analyticity. So the function is analytic here. And you can map it into the unit circle using something that's called the this transformation. And this goes under the name of the z-expansion. One of the reasons I like it, because it's not named after anybody. So everybody should feel free to use it. And the roots of this go back to the early 60s, maybe even late 50s. And what we can do now is that now our data is here in blue, and the form factor is in this nice analytic region. And now we can just do a Taylor series in the form factor. Now, the z-expansion is the method by now for meson form factors. People use it now for meson form factors. And Richard and I were the first to apply it, actually, to baryon form factors. So just to give you a feeling, so what this z-expansion looks like. So here is data. This is taken from a paper a couple years ago with an undergraduate student who was an RU student at Wayne State, Zach Epstein. He's now a PhD student in Maryland, and my PhD student, Joy Duproy. And this is just taking the magnetic form factor data for proton and neutron in blue and red. And what you see is something that looks like a curvature. And if you try to extrapolate to zero, you might say, well, there's a curvature there. But if you plot it as a function of z, things look much more flat. So the first time I saw this was in 2006. It's a write-up of a FPCP talk by Richard. And as soon as I actually saw this image, I knew that kind of z expansion is the right way to go, because it basically tells you that a lot of the stuff you think you're seeing here is not really there. So this can be approximated almost by a straight line. And people in the audience have worked on this. Sorry, there's a question?
So when you do the z-expansion, you take a pole out in this case? Or
I take a what, sorry?
Did you take a pole out?
No, I don't take a pole out. This is just plotting the data in the z variable. So I'm not going to be able, I don't have time to talk about this, but what you're thinking about is the fact some of this analytic structure can be taken out. It's easy for BDKs. For baryons, actually, there's a big problem there, because the so-called physical region related to cross-section starts at a 2-nucleon threshold, but the singularity starts at a 2-pion threshold. So if you want, there's a whole infinite number of resonances you need to take out. So that's actually a problem, a generic problem for baryon form factors. Okay, so in 2010, right after the muonic hydrogen result came out, Richard and I applied it to proton data. And then if you add proton and neutron data, you can separate things according to isospin. And you can also use pi-pi data. And the numbers we were getting are closer to this 0.88. That's different from the 0.84 that you get from muonic hydrogen. So that seems to favor the electronic hydrogen measurements. So this made it to PDG, actually before 2016, but this is just a picture from the 2016. You can extract similarly the magnetic radius of the proton using the data I just showed you, combining proton and neutron, and adding pi-pi data, and you get a value that's actually pretty similar to the electric radius, if you want, around 0.87 femtometers. And this is also something that is listed by the PDG starting from 2016. You can also do this for the neutron. The neutron has zero charge, but non-zero magnetic moment. And you can extract the neutron magnetic radius from the same data, and you get something that is, again, in the same ballpark, 0.89 with larger errors. And this also made it to the PDG 2016. So there's two extractions of the neutron magnetic radius. What the PDG does is basically average, and what you get is this value. Now, one thing to note, that this is using slightly a different method. So you can see, basically, there's a factor of a few between the two extractions. And that's kind of typical for extraction using the Z expansion. You tend to get like larger error bars, but we believe these error bars are more trustworthy. If you take the same data I've shown you before as a function of Z and just plot the proton and neutron data, you will see this nice kind of overlap. In fact, if I took the colors, probably you would find it hard to decide which one is proton, which one is neutron. That also kind of tells you, if you can imagine, continuing both of these lines to zero and seeing that you get the same slope. And this is indeed what you get, that within errors, our extraction, we find that the magnetic and magnetic radius of the proton and neutron are actually equal within errors. Yes?
What do you actually mean by this Z expansion? What is the interpretation of the point around which you expand?
The statement is Z, we call it the Z expansion because here's there's an expansion, right? There's Taylor expansion. If you want, there's just a transformation of this cut plane into the analytic region into the unit circle. There's a certain question here of, I should not go into that. But the statement is the function, you map the cut plane into this analytic circle, and now the function is analytic, and you can just expand in this function. Expand as a Taylor series. It's an analytic function in the variable z, right? This function is not, if I try to do a Taylor expansion, I'm going to hit the singularity. I can't do a Q-Stirrer expansion beyond the 2 pi on threshold, really. But the z expansion allows me to just do now a series that is with the region where the function is analytic.
And compute these coefficients ak.
So the coefficients, exactly. So the coefficient ak I get from data.
You fit.
I fit to the data here. To determine, this is probably the best picture, I just do a fit to determine the coefficient. Now there's a question how many terms you take, when do you stop, what conditions you apply. There's a whole discussion that I'm not going to get into, but I'm happy to discuss this more. And things are actually a little bit harder for baryon form factors for the same reason I talked about before compared to meson form factors.
Thank you. Can I ask about the data at low z?
Yeah, so this is just, we took the error bars directly from measurements as reported in the literature. We didn't do any kind of analysis or massaging into this data. Okay, but the point is actually you're not necessarily relying, this function is analytic, so actually everything kind of tells you something. You don't necessarily just need to rely on a small Q squared in that sense, that everything is connected by this analyticity form. So that's another nice thing about this. Okay, so they're equal within errors. It's an interesting question. The most recent, for the purpose of this talk, the most recent study was done by Gabe Lee, who's a postdoc at the Technion in Israel, John Arrington from Argonne, and Richard. And they analyzed the most recent, most accurate, what's so-called MINDS data set that was published in 2010, and world data excluding MINDS. So here are the studies from 2010 and 2015. You can compare these two things. This is a kind of more sophisticated analysis, but still the errors are, the values we get are consistent within error bars. Analysis of the world data that we did in 2014 also agrees within error bars with the analysis they did in 2015. And just for reference, this was the MINDS data. You can definitely see some tension here between the MINDS data for the proton magnetic radius and for the world data before MINDS for the magnetic radius.
So I think I missed something. Why do you think the MINDS data is?
I don't have an explanation for that.
Why did they think the MINDS data was different?
The answer is I don't know, or I don't remember more accurately. But if you look at the error bars, things are still consistent. The error bars are pretty large here, so you need to. I'm trying to remember whether it was like 2 sigma or something like this.
But it's unusual to do this, right? I mean, if you have a reason
to sorry,
separate out the data into two.
Oh, I did not show these numbers. I apologize.
I mean, people measuring the same thing.
Well, you also have to look at the error bars, right? So if you start adding, so here, let's say.
That's 3 sigma.
Yeah, something like this.
You know, but some people get excited.
Maybe you should ask. I mean, I did not do this. This is analysis done by Richard, but I don't think that they necessarily.
Maybe you said something early on that I missed in the very beginning. So what's special about the Mainz data compared to?
No, this is more accurate data. The accuracy of the data, it's a larger data set as far as I know, and it's much more accurate compared to the world data before that.
But it's the same observable.
It's the same observable, yes. So within the error bars, yes, this is a.
Okay.
Right, there's also other questions that I think you're going to talk a little bit about radiative corrections for some of this data. There's a question of radiative corrections. There's a question of whether you're extracting, because what they measure is actually the square of the form factors, and you need to fit to the cross section and things like that. I don't have an explanation. I'm just telling you the observation is that, sorry, which one I don't want to show. Am I looking? Yes, that's the correct one. Maybe this
the
is the better.
The other data sets, are they all sort of consistent with each other?
So the other data set is pretty much, at least for the data I analyze, this is pretty much the numbers you see here. So this is different data points between different.
Several experiments in the same plot?
Yeah, there's several experiments in the same plot.
I guess I don't understand how the number that's extracted relates to some physical observable on the spot. It's the slope.
It's the slope, yeah. Sorry. The charge radius would be the slope. So the question is, this is the world data for values of GM, is values of Q squared. Yeah. And now I'm going to...
And that's a linear function to within
it. So the answer would be, I can take a linear function, I can actually take many more terms. If I bound my coefficient as we do...
And that's part of your
It's part of it. Well, so you have to be careful. The bounding is a separate question from doing the Z expansion. Okay, so the maybe it's worth emphasizing. The Z expansion, now the question is, what do you say about your coefficients? So it turns out the size of the bound doesn't matter so much. You get pretty much the same. We played with these bounds. But this is actually a question that's worth discussing, I think, in more detail.
But there's some uncertainty that gets put in for the truncation of
There's what happens is when you bound the coefficient or you put some constraint, you know, you can expand up to a point and, you know, things don't change anymore. So that's the kind of
within
right. One of the question is there is a systematic uncertainty, if you want, is it's related to the fact that I was asked about before. You can do more robust bounds for meson form factors coming from unitarity. It's more difficult for baryon form factors. I think the issues of bounding coefficients is not something that lattice people even necessarily do systematically for meson form factors.
Magnetic form factor is the one that gets multiplied by Q squared when you go to zero, right? Zero Q squared. It's multiplied by Q squared in the cross section, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, as far as I recall. Okay, so I want to get to other things too. Okay, so I'm coming to the second part talking about hadronic uncertainty. This is work that was published very recently in PRD, it appeared last year. So there was a whole swirl of numbers here, but here is the bottom line. So if you look at the proton charge radius, not the magnetic radius, what you get is various extractions using the Z expansion. And what you'll find is values that are indeed on the higher end of the values. That you need to compare that to around 0.84 that you get from ionic hydrogen. So the bottom line is that basically using the Z expansion disfavors muonic hydrogen result. Now you can ask, is there a problem with the muonic hydrogen theory? As a theorist, this is a problem that
the
I
think. Proton,
this is. This is just using electron-proton scattering data. This is using slightly more data and slightly older data.
So just to make sure I understand, the Mainz measurement is not included in the third line.
Yes, exactly.
But it's included in the first line.
So it's not included in the third line because it appeared actually after a paper or the same time. Here, there's two numbers coming from, you know, the world versus Mainz
World excludes
minds. Exclude minds, yes. World means everything apart from minds. No comment. I have, you know, many colleagues or people that I appreciated that the statement is okay. So the minds data is actually very accurate, and if you put them together, you'll be fitting to the minds data pretty much.
EP data sets themselves are consistent, and then there's maybe a little less consistency between the EP data and the rest of the world data. That's what I would infer.
Between the minds EP data, you mean?
I would infer that.
They talk about the magnetic.
The minds and the other EP data. No, what you have here, the electric.
Right.
So I would infer that the minds and the world data are consistent for EP scattering, but the other data must be pulling significantly, right? Because the
in terms of.
So given that the third line contains the data from the first line.
No, you have to be careful. So this is actually a good question. So I did not go into that, of course, but one thing you can do when you add more data, if you can use that, is you actually push the beginning of the singularity. So what it does is basically it shrinks this blue line here. So the maximum size goes down, and in the limit where this would be pushed to infinity, you'll just get one dot, and you get zero error bar. So there's other effects here. It's not just taking extra data. There's other effects about changing or pushing the where you start your singularity. So specifically, if you separate things by isospin, you can separate data between 2-pion threshold and 3-pion threshold. So T cut is 4m pi. If you take this T cut to infinity, what you get is basically you're expanding with a variable that's actually zero size. So there wouldn't be any error bars in that case. So one is to be a little bit more careful in these things.
But still, there must.
It's not the extra data so much. I can tell you that from experience because we actually looked at this question. So it's not just the extra data that make the error bars. So you're looking. Sorry, I don't think I have the. No, this is probably a good. Yes. Okay, this is a good one. So this is the one you should look at because. This is analyzing the world data with the without any neutron or pi contribution. Okay, so that's the now there's an improvement that happens when you add more data, and it's not just the improvement of the data; it's the way that you're able to change your effective expansion variable. OK, moving on to the hadronic uncertainty. So the question is, there a problem with the muonic hydrogen theory? As a theorist, the question I'm interested in. So the answer is potentially yes. And this is something Richard and I pointed out in PRL in 2011. So what muonic hydrogen people do is measure an energy level difference and translate that to the charge radius. So they rely on theorists to give them a formula that they can use. So here's the formula used in 2010. And what you see here is a constant term. The units are millielectron volt. You have a constant term coming mostly from QED effects. You have a term that goes like R squared. And then there's a term in red. Notice the fact that the formula actually changed between 2010 and 2013. It's part of criticism, I guess, partly from our work. And what they get is there's an extra term here. And this extra term arises from this two-photon exchange. So the measurement is so accurate, you have to worry about higher order diagrams,
are
including
you
two for.
The
I am not missing the RE cube. What was done here in the analysis is you basically divide this in non rigorous way to something within the proton piece. Then you put in form factors, stick in form factors, and you assume your form factor is a dipole form factor, and then you expand everything, and you get only one parameter. But people are not doing this anymore, so you can just consider.
Why isn't it absorbed into the other first term?
Still weird.
So this is weird, okay? This is not something you should actually take seriously. The thing you should look at is this one.
That wasn't my question. My question is on the one I'm supposed to take seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Why are there two terms that are just constants?
Right.
And then one
because,
term that's multiplied by
right.
R squared.
Excellent question. So this is effect that comes from QED, perturbative QED. This is effect that comes from this two-photon exchange that has the thing that I will discuss, the hadronic uncertainty I want to talk about. This is just the effect that's related to the charge radius.
They're broken apart for purely illustrative reasons.
Not illustrative. There's a question. Here are terms you trust in QED, and this is terms that have to do with a truly nucleon or proton structure that are non-perturbative. There's non-perturbative physics that plays there.
So there's a polarizability there.
If you want, it contains the polarizability. There's also a question, I would argue, what do you mean by polarizability? Because that means different things, but I think everybody at least is happy with drawing this blob. And if you want to call this polarizability, that's fine. And I think a lot of people.
If the last term is not trustworthy, why are the errors so small?
No. So I did not say it was not trustworthy. I'm saying that this is a source of hadronic uncertainty. And this number, I will show this number, I think, this thing a little bit later on. But actually, my question would be, do we trust these errors? That's one of the things I'm actually going to focus on. OK, this is, if you want, state of the art in 2013. OK? Is there? So you have to be a little bit careful, you know, certain contributions that are absorbed into various terms. So you need to, there's a long laundry list of stuff.
So you don't necessarily compare the top to the bottom.
I'm not comparing the top to the bottom. The only thing I'm trying to highlight is that there's things that you trust, things that are dependent on R squared, and something that comes from the two-photon exchange. So that's the way the things are broken down. OK, so in any case, you need to worry about this two-photon exchange. So what do you do about this? Well, if you remove the lepton line, what you have is just a two-photon probe of the proton structure. And you can look at this object here, just the time order product of these two currents that you're probing. And you can parameterize in terms of two functions, W1 and W2. The imaginary part of these W1 and W2 give you something that everybody knows as the structure functions. So the imaginary part in general of these functions is related to data. And if I could reconstruct the full amplitude from its imaginary part, then there wouldn't be any problem because you can just use data to construct this object. Unfortunately, for W1, things don't fall off fast enough at infinity. For nu is roughly the photon energy in the rest frame of the proton, and q squared is just the four momentum transform squared. So the problem is basically the fact that you need subtraction for this W1 function, and to know everything about this two-photon exchange, you also need to know something about this function of q squared. So this is basically, if you want, photon-proton scattering, a virtual one, at zero energy. So let's say it again. The imaginary part of this two-photon exchange is related to data. Basically, if I take this diagram and I cut it in the middle, I can get either a proton or everything else. If it's a proton, it's a form factor. If it's everything else, x, this is just what we call the structure function. The problem is that you cannot reproduce the full amplitude from the imaginary part, and you need this non-perturbative function, W1, 0, q squared. So it's kind of a rule for precision physics encountering hadronic physics is a question of when, not of if. So at some level, you're going to run into some hadronic uncertainty. The question is, how do we deal with that? Well, there's some good news. So first of all, you can calculate it in the small q squared using NRQED. So this is something we pointed out in 2011. Now, NRQED stands for non-relativistic quantum electrodynamics. And this is something you're actually familiar with. It was just never called NRQED. So these are the components of the covariant derivative. And if you look at the Schrödinger equation, then these are the two terms, two parts of the Schrödinger operator, not including potential energy. Sorry, the potential energy is hiding inside IDT. Now, if you remember from quantum mechanics, you talk about the hydrogen fine structure, and you talk about things like spin orbit coupling, relativistic correction, and Darwin term. And these give rise to operators look like sigma dot b and d to the fourth and the divergence of e. Now, what you can do is you can just organize them in 1 over m expansion, and you will get a Lagrangian form. And this is the NRQED Lagrangian organized in increasing dimension size. So this is not new. So the origins of this is actually from the 20s, but the NRQD Lagrangian was written in 1986 by Caswell and Lepage. In 97, Manohar gave the 1 over m cubed terms. So you get more operators, of course. One thing to note, the last line here is 0 for QED, but it's non-zero for what is called non-relativistic quantum chromodynamics, NRQCD, that is useful for croconium studies, for example. So for some applications, you even need the 1 over m to the fourth term. And this is something that we did in 2013. This is together with Gabe Lee, I already mentioned his name, and Mikhail Solon, who's a postdoc at Berkeley now. And we actually saw some of these operators here. I think, where is Andrzej? He left the room? OK. This is one of the operators shown in Andrzej's talk a couple of minutes ago. Oh, sorry, a couple hours ago. And even more recently, the 1 over m to the 4th NRQCD Lagrangian was also found or given in these two papers. You saw this name before. This is Andrzej's PhD student. So Gunnar Wardana is my PhD student at Wayne State. Kobach is a postdoc at San Diego, and Paul is a graduate student in San Diego. So this is what it looks like. There's 25 operators. It's a little bit scary. But of course, this is all a question of getting used to these things. Some of these operators actually have coefficients that only start at higher orders in alpha s. But the important point is not this laundry list of stuff, but the fact that now there's actually a method that allows us to actually find arbitrarily high powers. OK, so going back to the NRQED. So using NRQED, you can actually constrain the small q squared. And the logic is the following. If you think if you're a photon here that comes in small q squared, what you see is the proton is basically almost like an elementary particle. And you can parameterize the deviation from the elementary particle behavior by using NRQED. So perhaps this is a better thing to look at. So what you get is this W10 q squared for small values of q squared. You get something that depends on the anomalous magnetic moment of the proton. You depend on the charge radius, the magnetic radius, the electric polarizability that was mentioned before. If you plug in the numbers, it doesn't even matter actually which values of the charge radius you're using. What you get is the following. You get a constant term, and you get a term that goes like q squared. And there's unknown terms that order q to the fourth. So you can just plot this. And here's the information about the function W10 q squared. Now I'm going to ask you in your mind to continue this function all the way to infinity. OK, so that's obviously could be many, many functions. So another thing you can do is say, well, what if I look at the high q squared? Well, the answer is it's calculable, the same function in the large q squared. And the reason is if you're a photon with lots of q squared, you can see the proton, the quarks and the gluons actually inside the proton. So what you get is a behavior that goes like 1 over q squared. And people have used this to estimate the two-photon exchange effect. Now, the coefficient here was calculated by John Collins in a paper that was submitted in 1978, October. How many people remember 1978? The brave people in the audience raised their hands. So I must have been very excited because it was a few days before my 5th birthday. But I don't have clear recollection. I have pictures from my 5th birthday in kindergarten. So this is a result that's been around for a long time. But the question, was it actually calculated by Collins in 1978? So let's look at this a little bit more carefully. So this function, as I said, or I did not say it, W10 q squared is dimensionless. You could have seen it in the previous slide here. And dimensionless functions are evil because you can't estimate their size. Because the question is 13 a large number? Is 100 a large number? Is 1,000 a large number? At least if things were had units, you could say, well, this cannot be 1,000 TeV or something. But it's a pure number. So you need to do this OPE calculation. You need to put some dimension for operator. And you can either have quarks operator or gluon operators. If you have quarks, you can have spin zero operator, QQ bar, or spin two operator. If you have gluons, this must be a color singlet because you're interacting with photons. And this is the general kind of two gluon thing you can have. And the question is, what is the gluon operators we can have? So let's do a little bit of accounting. So since this is called a singlet, you can forget about QCD in this case and just look at QED. So you have a product of electric or magnetic field with another electric or magnetic field. It turns out this product has 21 components. So one component is very well known, G mu nu, G mu nu, with contracting the A's is just the same as F mu nu, so you have one scalar. The pseudoscalar is also well known. You can also form a pseudoscalar E dot B that's ruled out by parity. You can find 9 components of a traceless symmetric tensor. This is the quorum magnetic stress energy tensor, usually called T mu nu in textbooks. So we only have 11 out of 21, so what else? There should be something else. Actually, I was here more than 2 years ago, and this was a problem that I was, I couldn't find anything in literature. So I had to calculate it, but the answer is the following. So you get this funny looking operator with 4 indices. This is the form of this operator. And for example, the 0, 1, 2, 3 component would be E1, B1 minus E3, B3. This is different from E dot B because E dot B will have a plus sign and include also E squared plus V squared. Well, it's interesting, but for protons, this thing is actually 0. You can prove that. The reason is the proton is too simple object for this type of operator. But I'm kind of wondering what happens if I use this two-photon probe inside a medium that doesn't necessarily have to be so symmetric. In particular, there could be some asymmetry between the 1 and 3 direction. So this is a solution looking for a problem. So if you have a problem this is relevant for, be happy to hear. Yes, you can do this in terms of representation theory, and you can also use that as an argument why this has to actually be 0. You can also do other things. You can use the fact that product of 2 epsilons is actually just G mu nu's, and you can show that this is just given by this one minus the other things. But for the purpose of this talk, it's irrelevant. This is just a fun fact, and since part of it was done here, I thought I should mention that. Okay, so the bottom line, we have the following possible operators. We can have quark spin 0 and spin 2 operators, and we can have gluon spin 0, spin 2 operators. These are the ones relevant for protons. So if you look at the title, this is renormalization of the Cottingham formula. So in 1978, Collins calculated electromagnetic corrections to the nucleon mass with an emphasis of the mass difference between neutron and proton. Now, the mass only depends on the spin zero operator, so you only need to worry about the QQ bar or the G mu nu, G mu nu. The problem is that from muonic hydrogen, you need the full tensor, so you also need to worry about these spin two operators. So what you need to do is actually calculate the spin two contribution. This is something that we did in a paper in 2016. So the conclusion is that actually Collins' result is not enough for muonic hydrogen.
Well, not use the fact that the energy momentum tensor then gives you the momentum and so on.
Sorry, what?
Well, if you have, you say this is the energy momentum tensor, right? So then you can, that's related to.
Right, right. So I will show one formula later on that actually, of course, there's a relation between the gluon and the proton, of the quark part of this. Not all these necessary matrix elements are going to be completely independent. You're completely right. So you need to do a one-loop calculation. And when we did that, we actually found a mistake in the 1978 calculation of the spin zero by Collins. So what Collins did is actually didn't calculate the spin zero gluon contribution. He extracted it from another calculation. And when he did that, he forgot to include a factor. And it's actually easy to understand what the factor. So if you see this photon here interacting with the quarks, you're sensitive to the charge of the quark. So you have to take the charge of the quark squared and just add up all the charge squared. Collins just did a simple sum of all these things. And the number is such that this is actually too large by a factor of 4.5, so almost by a factor of 5. OK, so that's not so bad. OK, this is Collins confirming that it's indeed a mistake. The problem is that even worse, the quark spin zero and gluon spin zero come with opposite signs. So after correcting this mistake, they actually largely cancel. So this function is actually dominated by the spin two contribution. So even if you were using the spin zero, it had a mistake in it, and it was kind of irrelevant or almost irrelevant for the large Q squared behavior. So the lesson is there's still some students in the audience is that's important to do a full calculation. And there's some good news. The mistake has no effect on the proton-neutron mass difference because the gluon contribution is the same at the lowest order in isospin breaking. The flip side of that is that you cannot use the proton-neutron mass difference to constrain muonic hydrogen, as some people have done. OK, so we're coming to the result. So this is the correct spin zero result. You have the matrix element here, and they're connected, as we'll discuss before. There's notice the difference in the minus sign here that caused it this kind of cancellation. The new spin 2 result is given by this expression. And you're parametrized in terms of matrix elements. They're also related to one another, the quark and gluon contribution. There's non-perturbative input you need from lattice, or you need from moments of the PDFs. And when you put everything together, this is what you get. So the spin 0 contribution is here. This is after correcting the mistake, and you find this cancellation. And what you find is the blue line here corresponds to the spin 2 contribution. And there's a certain error bar. OK, so what do you have? You want to find this function W10 Q squared. And you know the small Q squared. You know the large Q squared. And the problem is, like a joke that some people might know, is how to make a whole fish from a head and a tail. So before this work, we only had the low Q squared. Now we have the large Q squared. So now we can connect the dots. So what we did a very aggressive modeling. We assumed the OP is true when Q squared starts at 1 GeV squared. You could question this hypothesis, but let's just go along with this. We have unknown Q squared terms in the small Q squared. We have unknown terms in 1 over Q to the fourth in the high Q squared region. So we just model them by some uniform contribution. And when you put everything, this is what you get. So this is the small Q squared we've seen before. And this is the new OP result. OK, so at least on this scale, remember everything dimensionless is actually pretty close to 0. And again, I should point out that we're starting the Q squared, the OP, assuming it's valid when Q squared is 1 GeV squared. And you might argue that needs to be pushed a little bit further. OK, so now I'm going to ask you to connect the curves and tell me. So there's still hadronic uncertainty because I could take this line, go all the way to the first floor, go through the cafeteria, and then come back and connect the line here. Obviously, you would say this is unreasonable. Sorry, what?
Depends on the uncertainty.
No, I can still, again, if I don't know anything about this region, and nothing's stopping me from going down and down and down. Remember, what I'm plotting here is the only thing I know is the value and the slope, right?
But so. The principle of analytic continuation is unique.
So well, this is not analytic continuation, right? Because. So the statement is about controlling the region where neither small q squared nor high squared q squared. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, so what you can do is you can just connect the lines, and this is what you get when you just do interpolation, and this is kind of what it looks like.
What kind of interpolation?
I think we used the answer for me would be whatever Mathematica gives me when I asked it to interpolate with two parameters. But this is a simple interpolation, right? I mean, you can add a few more whatever higher powers of Q squared, but it's not going to change. This is connecting the dots.
Is this in the physical region for W1 or you?
So again, this is not like the form factor. This is the W10 Q squared. So calling it the physical region is slightly problematic because. Depend what you mean by physical. Sorry for causing some dizziness
like
for people.
Virtual Compton amplitude is one of them.
Exactly. So this would be completely virtual Compton. So this would be virtual forward Compton scattering with zero nu. That's the. Uh, Anyway, so when you look at the energy contribution, this is the kind of error bars you're going to get. To explain the puzzle, this contribution needs to be an order of magnitude larger. So there's caveats here. The OPE might be only valid for larger Q squared, and the W10 Q squared might be different from the interpolated lines. Similar results were found by other groups. This is a non-inclusive list, I guess, and this is the number I just showed you. This is taken from a paper. This is various extractions, and this is the value listed by the experimentalist in their theoretical study from 2013. Okay, so, well, we have a certain hadronic uncertainty. How to test it? Well, you need more data, and one possibility is to do muon proton scattering. So there's something called muon proton muse experiment, which stands for muon proton scattering experiment at PSI. And what you want to do now is connect muon proton scattering and muonic hydrogen using new effective theory that is called QED and RQED. I don't know how much time do I have. And 15. Oh, okay. So I can actually. So this is a theory we suggested a couple years ago. So let me say a few words how to connect muon proton scattering and muonic hydrogen. So muonic hydrogen, the muon momentum, we've seen this also in Andrzej's talk earlier, has a momentum of about 1 MeV. Both the proton and the muon is actually non-relativistic. For the muon kinematical region, the muon momentum is comparable to its mass. So the muon is relativistic, and the proton is still non-relativistic. So you can use something called QED and RQED effective theory, where you use QED for muon and use NRQED for proton. So what you're actually using is the fact that mu over mp is about 0.1 to be your expansion parameter. In many cases, you're going to go to second order, so things are even better than that. So this is the new effective field theory suggested in the paper from 2013 that I talked about before, and more recently with Stephen Dye, my PhD student, and Matt Gondering, our former postdoc at Wayne State, we looked at these theories. So for example, we can look at two-photon exchange at lowest order in 1 over m. So this is some technical details. Maybe I'll just show the results. So if you take the lowest power in 1 over m, this is what you get. You get the cross-section of the following form, where you depend on the various kinematical variables. This is just would be the regular Mott scattering, and this would be the radiative corrections. How many people have seen this formula before? Good. So can you go back to your office? This is actually not a new formula. It's derived within the effective theory. But this is the same result as scattering relativistic lepton off a static 1 over r potential. This is, as far as I know, the complete calculation was done with Dalitz in 1951. That's not the famous Dalitz paper. It's another Dalitz paper. And it's also reproduced in Itzigs and Zuber QFT textbook. You actually get the same result if you take the proton mass goes to infinity limit for point particle proton in QED scattering. It makes perfect sense because, because if the proton mass goes to infinity, the only sensitive to the proton charge, that's the only thing you can actually see in that limit. You don't see the charge radius, you don't even see the magnetic moment. You can also calculate 1 over m corrections using this QED and RQED effective theory. So for example, if you look at one photon exchange for muon proton scattering, you get the result that the QED and RQED is the same as 1 over m expansion of form factors. This is exactly what you would expect. The more interesting, of course, is doing two photon exchange. So this is the roadmap for the future. So you have information from QED and QCD in terms of form factors and structure functions. And if you go down in scale, you get to the 1 GeV scale. The proton is no longer relativistic. And you get to a regime where it's relevant for the muse experiment, where you depend on things that look like the charge radius and this funny hybrid contact interaction, where the proton is not a relativistic field, but the muon is still relativistic. And then you go down in energy to the muon mass scale, and you match onto an NRQED sector for both the muon and the proton, where you depend on a different type of contact interaction or a different type of two-photon exchange and the charge radius. So we need to match this contact interaction of QED and NRQED into NRQED and NRQED contact interaction. This is something we're working on, turns out to be more difficult than I initially thought it would be. But we're making progress. So this is a to-do list. You want to connect the contact interaction of the two theories. And that will allow you to calculate the cross-section from U's in terms of the charge radius and the contact interaction, or the two-photon exchange measured in muonic hydrogen. So the logic is muonic hydrogen depends on the proton radius and a two-photon exchange. The mu's cross-section will depend also on the proton radius and a two-photon exchange. And if you have two measurements with two unknowns, you can extract what the value of these things. And ideally, you want to find a direct relation between muon proton scattering and muonic hydrogen, even ideally a theorist-free relation that connects data to data. Of course, you need theorists to do this type of a connection. OK, so that was a lot of stuff to probably to throw at you, but here's the conclusions. So the proton radius puzzle is the 5 sigma discrepancy between muonic hydrogen and the charge radius extracted from regular hydrogen electron proton scattering. And last year, there was muonic deuterium results that find similar discrepancies published in Science. And after more than 6 years, next month I think it's going to be 7 years, the origin is still not clear. Is it a problem with the electronic extraction? Is it hadronic uncertainty? Is it new physics? And that really, as you saw throughout this talk, it really motivates a reevaluation of our understanding of the structure of the proton. I talked about three topics: extracting proton radii from scattering. So we use the tool of Z-expansion, and the studies disfavor muonic hydrogen. I talked about the first full and correct evaluation. Here's the object you're asking about, Andre: large Q-squared behavior of the forward virtual Compton tensor. And that allows you to improve the modeling of the two-photon exchange effects. And finally, very briefly, I talked about trying to create a direct connection between muon proton scattering and muonic hydrogen using a new effective theory, QED and RQED. There's much more work to do, and thank you. Yeah, so I didn't say anything about new physics. I actually kind of like the Jerry and collaborators' suggestion, because they were trying to be very agnostic about the nature of this new physics. It could be coupled differently for protons and neutrons. So I think it was good that they did this type of analysis where they just don't assume anything about the coupling, since we don't know anything about this new physics explanation. It was just a scalar interaction where they had different coefficients between, they actually write a potential, it's not even Lagrangian. It creates a certain potential and it has different couplings to protons and neutrons. But it's interesting, it's not so easy to come up with a new physics explanation. You need to break lepton universality, right? So it's a lot easier to come up with. And it's not even connected to UV complete model. There's actually, Maxim is not here. He also wrote some models that related to that.
So there are new physics proposals.
There are new physics proposals, yes. They're not necessarily beautiful or whether the UV complete, probably the honest estimate would be it's not really UV complete. And again, you need to break lepton universality. There's a lot of constraints on left-hand coupling from neutrino physics. It's not easy. Otherwise, it would have been, like the 750 GeV Higgs. There would be a order of 1,000 papers. So it's not easy.
So I heard there's like a preliminary result from helium-3, muonic helium-3 and helium-4. Are you aware of that?
So as far as I understand, for helium, they don't find this discrepancy. I know I'm being recorded, so I should be careful. Some of these things also depend on polarizability for helium. We're having problems with the polarizability of the proton. So naively, I don't see how it's better for, but I'm told that it's actually better for heavier nuclei because it makes the calculation easier. But I can't say, I did not study these calculations. So. So you could try apply different, yes. So this would be a different, you have to look at the spin that you're working with, and this would be a slightly different. So the function I was showing was sandwiched between protons or neutron states. This would be a different state. So from a rigorous model-dependent approach, this would be different beasts, basically.
Okay.
Yes. Can you go back to the dispersion relation of the structure function?
Sure.
So basically, how do you argue that like it's not converging?
Ah, excellent. So.
The second question: do you see it in the data?
Do you see it in the data? So. In the published version of this paper, and hopefully very soon in the archive version, sorry, I should be here, there's actually a simple argument that comes from low energy constraints on the scattering that you just cannot have a non-subtracted dispersion relation. That's the most robust argument. There's some Reggie behavior argument from the 60s, but you can make a complete low energy constraint that says you just cannot get. If you did not do the subtraction, you would get the cross-section to be non-positive. So it's in a footnote in the published version of a paper, and soon going to be a footnote. What, sorry? Of my paper, yes. Some people know it, some people don't. It's not necessarily kind of appears in literature, but we just added the footnote just for that. But the answer would be low energy physics constraints. You have to ask more questions. What do you mean? If I have any questions? Oh, in terms of the studies, the answer would be no. From a theorist's perspective, it's true that if you look at individual measurements, they're not five sigma away from the muonic hydrogen. You have to average everything in order to see that. But for regular hydrogen, it's easier because you're only sensitive to the charge radius. You don't worry about these two photon exchange because it's much smaller effect.
Okay, thank you, Gail.
Thank you.